This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Coming up, Papua New Guinea remembers the legacy of their first Prime Minister and Father of a Nation, Grand Chief Sir Michael Somare. There are concerns about Papua New Guinea's airport quarantine program, with leaked documents highlighting holes in the system. And Kiribati has announced plans to work with China in developing land on the Fijian island of Vanualevu. Known fondly as the Grand Chief and PNG's founding father, Sir Michael Somare was also one of his country's longest-serving politicians, with a career that spanned five decades. Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby has been taking a look back at Sir Michael's remarkable life and career.
You're with National Radio in Papua New Guinea in 1975, Independence Year.
On the 16th of September 1975, a young nation was born in the Pacific, and a young charismatic man called Michael Thomas Somare became Papua New Guinea's first Prime Minister. His job was to unite the territory of Papua and New Guinea that had been under Australian colonial rule. In the 1960s, Australian government's enthusiasm to keep trying to run the territory was diminishing. But at just 39, Michael Somare didn't always think he could be Prime Minister.
A lot of people in this country thought, we wouldn't be able to do it. They were talking in terms of two or three decades, while I was talking in terms of a few years. One stage in Australia, I said, I don't see it, you know. I cut out myself with a Prime Minister, and that's one of my quotations in Australian paper. I never thought, you know, by forming the first political party that we would be able to see it through. But then when I know that I had a lot of support from young Papua New Guineans, I thought, well, I think we should be able to make it.
The leaders of that time were young, energetic, idealistic and nationalistic. Sir Michael Somare was among those who thought it was time to free PNG from Australian rule.
During the time, I was not referred to by my name. Instead, I was given a serious number in Australian colonial territory where I once held an Australian passport. We had a few rights and our opinions were given to us. Mr. Speaker, many things have changed, and I hope that in 100 years from now on, Papua New Guinea will realize importance of being an independent country.
It was no easy task to unite 800 different tribes and form one country. For those who watched Sir Michael's political career knew he was unique, including the ABC's former PNG correspondent Sean Dorney.
Sir Michael is absolutely unique. And there is no one else in the rest of the Pacific or Australia or New Zealand who has had anywhere near the political career that he has had. But he has been around for so long, and it's not that he's just been around. He actually dragged the country through to independence, and I don't know if people quite appreciate how difficult that situation was.
Sir Michael would go on to stay in Parliament for 49 years. He was Prime Minister on three separate occasions over that time, 17 years in total, but also served as the Foreign Affairs Minister, Leader of the Opposition and the local Governor of East Sipik Province. Sean Dorney says the senior PNG statesman used most of his time in politics.
Australia was pretty pleased to get out when it did. So I don't know if PNG could have kept the Australians here for much longer, because the enthusiasm in Australia to keep trying to run this incredibly complex and difficult country was not there anymore. But what Sir Michael proved is that it is possible to run this incredibly difficult and complex country.
Sir Michael Somare is known affectionately in PNG as the Grand Chief, a nod to his Melanesian leadership that was based on the big man status. but also on ensuring there was consensus in key decisions. He was born into it on the 9th of April 1936. His father, Ludwig Somare, was a policeman in the town of Rabaul, but he also held tribal leadership in the East Sepik, bearing the name Sana, which means peacemaker. Young Michael was exposed to those traditional values early on in his life, and they stayed with him. It helped him as he led the Pangu Party, one of PNG's oldest political parties, before he was sacked from the leadership, and he then joined the National Alliance Party and became Prime Minister again in 2002.
You can be rest assured that there's a solidarity being built, and we are a solid group.
Sir Michael's 5 decades in PNG politics wasn't without controversy, though. The changing landscape meant that younger, ambitious politicians were coming up to challenge Sir Michael.
One country, two prime ministers. Papua New Guinea is in the grip of a constitutional crisis.
In 2011, when Sir Michael had been out of the country for 5 months, having heart surgery in Singapore, he was disqualified from parliament and the prime minister's post. He was replaced by Peter O'Neill, but it led to a constitutional crisis when both men claimed to be PM. But Sir Michael was narrowly backed by the country's Supreme Court, which found there was no vacancy in the office of the Prime Minister. It ordered he return, but the elder statesman was shouted out of Parliament.
There is a forum, there is a stranger, there is a stranger, there is a stranger!
They're repeating the same thing until Speaker give us the seats.
Yeah.
Now to throw themselves on the floor of Parliament causing disruption is very, very childish, naive, irresponsible and a reckless attitude.
In the end, the people of Sir Michael's East Sepik province voted him back into Parliament in 2012. 5 years later, his political career finally came to an end, retiring and addressing the Parliament House for the last time.
We progress through many waves and changes in the world. We survived our own bad decisions. We have united at times when the world thought it was not possible to do so. We must be thankful and we must always count our blessings.
People in Papua New Guinea knew him affectionately as the Grand Chief or the Father of the Nation. He was married to Lady Veronica Somare.
I've been a man of principle, rules and determine my conduct through my life. I am blessed with a woman who has been my friend, for my guide. Friend and my guide since we were both young together. We have 6 children. I gave my best years in this country and I serve as a politician. And I hope you will each find the grace to continue our dream of our great nation, Papua New Guinea. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The late Grand Chief Sir Michael Somare, the man regarded as Papua New Guinea's founding father and his country's first prime minister, who died at the age of 84, confirmation coming in an official statement from his daughter. And our reporter there in Port Moresby was Bethany Harriman. Major holes have emerged in Papua New Guinea's COVID-19 control system. Leaked documents obtained by the ABC reveal key workers are still waiting to be paid, and there are question marks over the enforcement of quarantine for some international arrivals. As our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports, a temporary field hospital is being reopened in Port Moresby to take the new patients as isolation wards at 2 hospitals in the capital reach capacity.
It's all double layer to give you maximum protection.
Yes. Seamstress Rose Nico started selling masks in Port Moresby when the pandemic hit. But she's not selling as many now as she did last year.
The way this sickness is, we cannot take for granted. So although the infections and everything is really low, we have to keep on using masks.
So far, PNG has recorded just over 1,100 cases and 10 deaths. Concerns about complacency aren't restricted to members of the public. A ministerial briefing from PNG's National Control Centre for COVID-19 has warned critical functions are at risk of collapsing because some staff haven't been paid. The leaked document obtained by the ABC says 40 workers haven't been paid for 5 months and are threatening to stop work. The country's health minister, Jelta Wong, says bureaucratic issues are to blame.
We're working through that now. The secretary's been tasked to make sure and ensure that the people that are working in the front line get paid. And he's assured me that it will happen.
The document also highlighted problems enforcing the two-week quarantine for international arrivals, including concerns some ministers were trying to exempt people from quarantine, which they don't have the authority to do. Mr. Wong believes ministers are following the rules once the system's explained to them, but he said he is worried about the quarantine program.
We're going to take it very seriously now, so if anybody is caught breaking the law, the consequences are going to be very high.
More than 60% of the cases detected in PNG have been asymptomatic. It's thought PNG is likely only dealing with the early strain of COVID-19 because it was quick to shut its borders last year. But with new variants appearing globally, experts say maintaining the quarantine system is vital. Anna Marlson from the World Health Organization says low testing rates mean some cases may also have been missed.
Health-seeking behaviour in general is often low, and PNG has a very young population. So the severe cases we see in other countries are usually linked to older adults.
There's been a rise in cases recently, with more than 130 recorded in the country since Thursday. The pandemic controller is among them, and the ABC understands at least three members of parliament are as well. A field hospital at a sporting facility in Port Moresby that had been closed is reopening, with authorities saying it is urgently needed, with isolation wards at two local hospitals now full. Meanwhile, in the town of Vanimo, 13 out of 37 hospital staff have tested positive to the virus, creating critical shortages. Matt Cannon from St John Ambulance is concerned the number of cases may keep climbing.
But the concern is between now and when the vaccine arrives, if we are going to see a spike in cases, how are we going to respond to that?
The earliest a voluntary vaccine program could start in PNG is thought to be April, but it's dependent on government approvals and supplies.
PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reporting there. There's no doubt that the COVID-19 pandemic has touched us all in some way and changed our lives. Michaeline Urbis is a PNG woman who lives in Melbourne, and this is how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted her life.
When most people had lost their jobs, I was actually fortunate to still have a job and actually work in the office due to the industry I was in. So the restriction of movement, that affected me more. That was quite difficult. I mean, for myself, I generally like to go outside, walk a lot, go see the nature, you know, parks, hiking, things like this. I especially like going to the beach. And because I live quite inland and the nearest beaches are more than half an hour away from me, I found that difficult. So it was difficult going to the same park every day, that kind of thing. We've tried to work more in finding alternative ways to connect with the community because, you know, as Pacific Islanders, it is something important for us, like culturally, to always be connected with our community, especially when you don't actually have a lot of family. We just connect with our communities.
That was Michaeline Urbis telling her story there. The government of Vanuatu is requesting more information from Australia following reports that more than 50 Nevan seasonal workers have had their employment terminated. Details are sketchy, and Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister Ismail Kalsakau is calling for answers. But in the Queensland city of Bundaberg, pastoral workers have been providing support to distressed Pacific Island labourers who are out of a job. However, as Evan Wasuka reports, the situation could be more complex than it seems.
Vanuatu is the biggest provider of labourers to Australia under the seasonal worker program, with over 2,700 workers in the country as of January this year. But a tweet from Vanuatu's High Commissioner to Australia describing 50 of his countrymen getting the sack from a farm in Queensland has set off alarm bells across the Pacific. In Vanuatu's capital, Deputy Prime Minister Ismail Kalsakau is calling for answers.
Talking with Australian High Commissioner Ian Portino and trying to get a hold of the reasons why they missing terminated. And once we get all the information of the reason and whether we'll be able to be in a position to respond or react to it.
But it's a complicated situation, as the ABC has been told that the workers at Bundaberg are not under the SWP, as they had left their approved employer last year to take up new work. Sister Janine Bliss is from the Australian Catholic Religious Against Trafficking of Humans in Bundaberg.
They're facing terrible situation. Most of them have been labelled as runaways or absconders. And this is a term that's derogatory, obviously. So there needs to be some work done on addressing the real issue for this particular group of seasonal workers. Why have they run away from their original employment?
The ABC has previously reported on seasonal workers leaving their employers because of a lack of work hours, low pay, high accommodation costs, and exploitation. Others have also been lured by the offer of higher and better pay. Sister Janine says regardless of whether or not they're with a government program, there's a crisis going on in Bundaberg.
Over the weekend, they were advised. So on Friday, I think I heard between 20 and 30. On Saturday, the number had gone up to 50. And then Sunday, I was hearing 70. So we're still trying to ascertain the exact number. But the High Commissioner has met with all the workers and interviewed most of those workers.
Vanuatu's High Commissioner to Australia, Samson Farevivili, is currently in Bundaberg but hasn't responded to the ABC's request for more information. Sister Janine says the details aren't clear right now and she's calling for Australian authorities to investigate.
They're certainly distressed at losing their jobs. None of them have received letters advising them of their situation, you know, termination letters. So, like, that needs to be investigated, I suppose, as to why they haven't received termination letters or actually been advised that they were going to be terminated. In Australia, the law is that you get 3 warnings before you're terminated or sacked. You know, it's another big issue that needs to be investigated.
Since the resumption of the seasonal workers program this year, Vanuatu has led the way in providing workers to Australia. Deputy Prime Minister Ishmael Kaltsakau says it's too early to say if this latest incident will affect the program.
At the present time, it's premature to comment about it. We need to know the reasons for the dismissals. At the present time, we will always enjoy a good relationship with the Australian government.
Sister Janine believes this type of situation could also be happening in other parts of Australia and not just in Bundaberg.
Other Pacific Island nations that have got seasonal workers here to check with your people, find out what's going on, offer as much support and importantly, pastoral care. And we need to be united in our response. This isn't just happening, I'm sure, with people from Vanuatu. Like all Pacific nations that are signed on with the seasonal worker program need to be aware of situations that can affect their workers and be committed to their welfare.
Sister Janine Bliss from the organisation Australian Catholic Religious Against Trafficking in Humans, ending that report from Evan Wasuka. Kiribati has announced plans to work with China in developing a huge piece of land on the Fijian island of Vanualevu. The 5,500-acre estate was purchased in 2014 as a place for Kiribati citizens to relocate if their islands became uninhabitable due to climate change. According to former President Anote Tong, the land has been sitting idle ever since. But the Kiribati government is now working on development plans, and to learn more now, we're joined by reporter Marion Farr. First of all, Marion, what can you tell us about this huge piece of land?
This property is known as Natoa Vatu Estate. And it was bought by Kiribati in 2014. It was purchased off the Church of England for about $8.7 million. And it's located on the island of Vanua Levu in Fiji. Now, the reason for the purchase of this piece of land was both practical but also intended to make a statement to the world. So then-President Anote Tong, who was responsible for buying this estate, said it could be used as a place for the people of Kiribati to relocate if climate change got so bad that the country's islands weren't inhabitable. And that sort of sent a message about the response to climate change and just how serious Kiribati was taking this threat. And it's also sparked a lot of discussion worldwide about, you know, other Pacific nations doing similar, like making a similar strategy.
Right. So that was back in 2014. So what's happening to the land now?
Well, according to Anote Tong, the former president, the land has just sort of been sitting there and it hasn't really been used up until this point. But last week, the topic came up in a press conference when the current president, Tanis Mamau, was asked about his plans for the estate. And in his response, President Mamau said the government was engaging with China over plans to develop the land. And that was sort of picked up on social media, and these rumours sort of developed that the government was actually planning to sell or give the land away to China, and that really sparked quite a bit of discussion and really attracted some criticism on social media.
And how did the government respond to that?
Well, just yesterday, the government came out with a very strong statement refuting those claims. It basically says it's not planning to sell the land, and it sees the estate as still a good investment for Kiribati, and noting that it's got, you know, good agricultural soil, it's got access to the seafront because it's on the coastline and ports. But it did say there were plans underway to develop the land and that Kiribati has been engaging in discussions with China about how to do that.
That is quite interesting. So what exactly is it planning to develop?
Well, that unfortunately is a little bit unclear. So in its statement, the Kiribati government said it was looking at possible projects. Now, that's a very vague term. We don't really know what that means. It also said a strategic plan has been developed, but again, didn't give any real detail about that. One thing it did mention is that Kiribati has already been working closely with China in developing its local agricultural sector in Kiribati, and that was feeding into this partnership. So perhaps that's something we might see as part of this strategic plan, is and the development of agriculture and crops on the estate. But really, we haven't got much more detail than that.
And Kiribati has been strengthening its ties with China, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So especially under the new president, or the current president, Tanis Mamau. So he, in 2019, cut ties with Kiribati's former ally, Taiwan, and really strengthened this relationship with China. And so perhaps it isn't a huge surprise that Kiribati is choosing to partner with China when it comes to developing this estate.
Of course, an important question here is, how have locals reacted?
It's been quite mixed. There's been a fair bit of criticism towards the idea of selling the land or giving it away to China. But of course, the Kiribati government has now come out and said that's untrue and, you know, really worked to shut down those rumours that have been spreading on social media. I also spoke with the former president, Anote Tong, earlier, and he said he was in favour of the land being developed as an investment. So, you know, growing crops could improve food security for Kiribati. But he did question whether China was the right country to be partnering with. And here's what he had to say.
I'm in support of trying to find ways of making use of the land. The question really is, would China be a partner that I would choose? And I think what I did would have answered that question itself, because I did not choose China in 2003. I chose to partner with Taiwan, and so if I was asked the question, the answer would have been no. What the current government is doing, it may be an option. I really don't know. I know that in Fiji they've had some problems with some of the developments that the Chinese private sector have been involved in, in Fiji.
Former President of Kiribati, Anote Tong, ending that report from Marion Farr. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Marla Damati. Thanks for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.